Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated May 10th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's Triangle Business Journal, front page, top of the fold. This article's entitled, State of Credits, North Carolina Firms Get Millions of Dollars in Tax Credits, by Amanda Jones Hoyle from Raleigh. IBM has claimed more than $24 million in tax credits on its North Carolina income tax filings over the past 2 years, but not for creating jobs. The credits fall under a law that allows write-offs for research done in the state. Chapel Hill-based Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina is known for writing insurance, not for investing in old factories. But that's just what the company did, and under a separate corporate tax credit law, the company claimed a write-off of $28 million. The company says it will turn the former R.J. Reynolds tobacco warehouses in Winston-Salem into research labs, retail, and office space. Although tax credits often are touted as job creators, many that are claimed by corporations operating in North Carolina do not directly boost employment. In fact, more than two-thirds of tax credits claimed are for investments for specialized purposes, such as the rehabilitation of historic factories, investments in renewable energy infrastructure, construction of low-income housing, and film projects. In 2012, more than 400 companies and individuals across the state filed tax credit claims valued at $323 million, or a third of the $1 billion the state collects each year in corporate income tax revenue. And claims are increasing, a testament both to their popularity and to an improving corporate review picture. Tax credit claims are up by 31% over the year prior, according to a report prepared by the North Carolina Department of Revenue. As for job creation credits, Raleigh tax accountant Heather Dean says it's sometimes difficult for companies in regions such as the Triangle to qualify for them because regulations are stiffer for wealthier counties. But she says the state's other tax incentives can still influence where a company makes an investment, whether in this state or another. I know the research and development credit has helped some of our clients perform the R&D here rather than somewhere else, says Dean, a partner with the Hughes Pittman Gupton accounting firm in Raleigh. When there is an option, the credits can be a driver in that decision-making process. One of the newest corporate tax credit options, which was added to the books this year, is what's known as Interactive Digital Media Credit, which targets the video game and digital media industry. In its first year, 24 taxpayers filed $2.56 million in tax credit claims under the law, which makes more than five times what state lawmakers had projected. About 92% of the claims, though, were from investors and executives, or former executives and investors, from one company, Epic Games of Cary, the creator of the Gears of War game series. Epic Games founder Timothy Sweeney filed for a credit of $1.57 million, the largest such claim according to state documents. Other current or former Epic employees and the amount of credits claimed are Mark A. Rain, $376,170, Stephen E. Polge, $194,195, Michael V. Capps at $128,246, and Andrew Scheidecker, $93,465. Sweeney's claim was larger than one filed by SAS co-founder Jim Goodnight, who claimed $702,000 in tax credits in 2012 for his personal investments in business property and job creation efforts at SAS. When the Interactive Digital Media Tax Credit was enacted into law in 2010, the General Assembly's Fiscal Research Division estimated it would cost the state only about $500,000 in its first year. From a budgetary concern, I'm sure the state will have to tweak it a little bit, but hopefully the economic benefits of job creation and the payrolls these companies are creating will help in the grand scheme of things, Dean says. The reality is these credits are being utilized. A lot of them are using this as a subsidy to help attract really good talent. Marty Reed, a corporate incentives consultant with Ocean Township, New Jersey-based Walton Management Services Incorporated, says most states have some sort of corporate tax credits on the books. States, he says, are aggressive in adding them as a way to attract and maintain jobs. Tax credits are not as valuable as other incentives now, he says. If you make money and pay taxes, the credits are useful. But some companies may never use that credit, or it may expire before you can use it. For North Carolina legacy companies like Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, the state's tax credit laws have allowed a reinvestment of those savings into other parts of their businesses. As for BCBSNC's investment in the Winston-Salem tobacco warehouses, company spokesman Lou Borman wrote in an email, "Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina's investment in the North Carolina Mill Rehabilitation Tax Credits Program serves both as an investment in the economic vitality of North Carolina and an element in the overall diversification of Blue Cross and Blue Shield's North Carolina investment portfolio. In line with this, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina expects a market-based return, the creation of North Carolina jobs, and preservation of a significantly historic building." Still on the front page, "Wherefore goeth State's Tax Code?" This article is also by Amanda Jones Hoyle, and it is also from Raleigh. As it stands now, popular job creation and business investment tax credits that many North Carolina companies have been claiming on their returns for the past 18 years are set to go out of existence, or sunset, on January 1, 2014. That may or may not happen as state legislatures are considering a number of initiatives, including a complete overhaul of the state's tax code. The majority Republican leadership, led by Senator Phil Berger on May 7th, laid out key points of a new tax system that would cut both personal and corporate income tax rates and eliminate the estate tax. It would also impose sales taxes on food, prescription drugs, and some tax-exempt services, but work is just beginning on the bill. Until the smoke clears, state, regional, and local corporate recruiters say they aren't even mentioning state tax credits to corporate prospects that are considering an investment in the state that would happen after January 1. "If a project was going to start in early 2014, we wouldn't want to promise a credit that's not on the books," says Josh Ellis, spokesman for the North Carolina Commerce Department. When MetLife was negotiating in February what turned out to be a $90 million incentives package in exchange for 2,600 jobs it now has promised to create in Cary and Charlotte, documents show that the Commerce Department staff was conservative in its estimates of potential tax credits for which the company could qualify. They acknowledged in the document that the tax credits could expire in January. Ellis says recruiters aren't sure what to tell companies at this point regarding the state's future tax structure. "Everything's on the table right now for tax reform," he says. "There are so many moving pieces. And it's not just what's known as Article 3J credits, which benefit qualifying companies that create jobs or invest in equipment. The sunset will also impact companies that claim credits for research and development, biodiesel production, interactive digital media and work opportunity, as well as economic incentive refunds of sales and use taxes for passenger air carriers, motorsports teams, and analytical services businesses. Some businesses have very tight margins and tax credits might be built into their financial model, which may mean the difference of investing in North Carolina or not," says Marty Reed, a corporate incentives consultant with Ocean Township, New Jersey-based Walton Management Services Incorporated. But that's not typically the case. Different companies have different drivers. Heather Dean, a partner at Hughes, Pittman & Gupman, says that more important than tax credits to most companies she works with is the state's talent pool of workers. "Anything we can do as a state to encourage talent to come here and stay here is a good thing," she says. Joseph Hinchman, Vice President of State Projects for the Tax Foundation, A nonpartisan think tank in Washington, D.C. has been working with state lawmakers and business leaders in North Carolina on tax reform laws over the past several months after releasing a 77-page report in January that outlined four tax reform options for North Carolina. While none of the tax foundation options resemble the plan that Senate leaders have proposed, Hinchman says he's still in talks with state and local business leaders. Regarding the state's tax credits, Hinchman says the foundation's research has generally found that many of the companies that claim tax credits on investments would have made the investments anyway, with or without the credit. If they wouldn't have done it anyway, it's usually a bad economic decision, Hinchman says. If it's a bad economic decision, they likely will close in a couple of years or never add the jobs they had promised. The Tax Foundation report was commissioned by Carolina Business Coalition, a pro-business organization formed in 2011 that includes Glenn Raven, President and CEO Alan Gant Jr., former BB&T Chairman and CEO John Allison, former GlaxoSmithKline Executive Robert Ingman, former Governor Jim Martin, and Dole Food Company Chairman David Murdoch among its board leadership. Moving inside the front cover, Salix remains in scuffle with partner over drug. This article is by Jason DeBrun and is from Raleigh. Despite having FDA approval and manufacturing contract for a new anti-diarrhea drug, Salix Pharmaceuticals has yet to produce a single dose of the drug, even in the face of a pending lawsuit. It's seemingly a contradictory business move. Salix, Raleigh's largest homegrown drug manufacturer, could be generating revenue on the product called Fulizac, a drug to reduce the onset of diarrhea in adult patients living with HIV/AIDS on antiretroviral therapy. Diarrhea is a side effect of the therapy that treats HIV/AIDS. Before it received approval for Fulizac on December 31st, Salix licensed the compound from San Francisco-based Napo Pharmaceuticals, which would receive a portion of Fulizac's sales. Napo's leadership has complained that Salix is dragging its feet in launching the product, even questioning Salix's motives, suggesting Salix is intentionally holding off on a launch in order to promote its own drugs so it can retain a larger portion of revenue on sales of those products. Although none of Salix's other products are approved specifically for the same use as Fulizac, it's possible that the other drugs could be prescribed to patients in what is called an off-label use, meaning that it's not explicitly for that particular condition, but doctors prescribe it because it could work to treat that condition. Drug companies are strictly forbidden from marketing their drugs for off-label use. Salix has received a subpoena from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York requesting documents regarding its sales and promotional practices for three of its drugs, including Xyazan, which makes up 70% of Salix's net product revenue. Salix and Napo struck a deal in December 2008, and Napo could be on the receiving end of $250 million if certain sales thresholds are achieved by Fulizac. In 2012, Salix recorded net product sales of $735 million and a net income from operations of $172 million. Salix is languishing, says Bill Olmeyer, a partner with the law firm of Boies, Schiller, and Flexner, who represents Napo. They don't have any drug. They've done very little, and you have to ask yourself, why? Napo has already filed a lawsuit against Salix. Napo earlier complained that Salix dragged its feet in seeking approval for the drug. The company has now amended its complaint to say that Salix has dragged its feet on producing the drug. In response, Salix, through emailed statements, says the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has imposed release specifications on Fulizac because it's a naturally occurring complex mixture of several different compounds. Salix has been working with FDA to finalize the release specifications pursuant to which product will be released to the market, according to the statement. While the FDA has not made a definitive determination on the acceptability of the manufactured supplies, for release to the market. We are hopeful that we will hear from FDA on this in the near future. We stand ready to expedite the commercial launch of Fulazac upon final release by the FDA. Company representatives were not more specific about the specifications. Ohlmeyer called the response positive spin on a situation that they've created and again pointed out that the product was approved by the FDA on December 31st, saying it's unclear what these release specifications would refer to. Moving now to the Real Estate Watch column by Amanda Howell, Carolina Inn unveils a $19 million update. This article is from Chapel Hill. The Carolina Inn is wrapping up more than 4 years and $19 million worth of renovations, a project that has touched nearly every surface of the nearly 90-year-old hotel. And the work was wrapped up just in time for the influx of parents and alumni celebrating graduation ceremonies this weekend. This has been a real, total overhaul, says Carolina Inn General Manager Jack Schmidt, who was hired in the middle of the renovation process about 2 years ago. There's not much of the building left that's 90 years old. UNC Chapel Hill, which owns the inn, started renovating the historic hotel's 185 guest rooms and suites in 2008. But the second phase of the project, to renovate the meeting rooms and other public spaces, was delayed due to budget constraints, Schmidt says. But the project, in the end, he says, came in on budget and with relatively little interference to the inn's guests. What will guests notice most? In each guest room, he says, every bathroom, drywall, piece of furniture, fixture, drapery, paint, and carpet has been replaced. In the meeting rooms, everything that is viewable to the public eye has been refreshed. But that doesn't mean the inn's history has been thrown away. Listed on the National Register of Historic Places, the Carolina Inn recently won a Best Practices Award from the National Trust Historic Hotels of America program for an extensive collection of historical displays, which were added as part of the renovation. Continuing on, architecture firms are rebounding in the Triangle, and a 2012 study by McGraw-Hill Construction and a parallel survey of American Institute of Architects members found that most U.S. firms expect a shortage of qualified designers to meet their workloads by 2014. This was after the 2008 recession slashed the workload for firms, leaving many architects jobless for months or even years, and forcing many in the profession to quit and find work in other career fields. But in the Triangle, it is more likely a lack of design support staff that would most impact the local design community. After a review of surveys submitted each year by the largest architecture firms in the region for the Triangle Business Journal's annual book of lists, the numbers show that while overall employment at the Triangle's largest architecture firms continues to decline, down 31% so far between 2008 and 2012, the number of registered architects employed by the top firms early in 2012 surpassed even the market peak of 2008. This week's column of Healthcare Nonprofits and Education by Jason DeBruin features an article entitled, Big Change in Federal Student Aid is Coming. College students applying for federal aid will see some big changes beginning with 2014-15 school year, especially in regards to the relationship of a student's parents. For the first time, the U.S. Department of Education will collect income and other information from a dependent student's legal parents, regardless of the parent's marital status or gender, if those parents live together. Known commonly as the acronym FAF-SA, the Free Application for Federal Student Aid Program will provide a new option for dependent applicants to describe their parents' marital status as unmarried and both parents living together. Additionally, the new FAFSA form will use terms such as parent one, parentheses, father slash mother slash step-parent, close parentheses, and parent two, parentheses, father slash mother slash step-parent, close parentheses, instead of specific gender terms like mother and father. All students should be able to apply for federal student aid within a system that incorporates their unique family dynamics, said U.S. Secretary of Education Arne Duncombe in announcing the changes. These changes will allow us to more precisely calculate federal student aid eligibility based on what a student's whole family is able to contribute and ensure taxpayer dollars are better targeted towards those students who have the most need, as well as provide an inclusive form that reflects the diversity of American families. Although a new crop of students is heading into the job market this month, a whole new set of students, and especially their parents, are beginning to think of how to pay for college. The College Foundation of North Carolina, CFNC, the organization that helps students and families learn how to pay for college in North Carolina, has kicked off a campaign encouraging college attendance and putting itself out there as a resource for educating families on options for grants, subsidized loans, and other ways of paying for college. The FAFSA is the first step to receive all federal aid, ranging from grants to low-income to low-interest federal loans, so it's important to fill out the form, says Ben Kittner, who heads up market research at CFNC, explaining that the form is also required to receive state grants and scholarships. He encourages anyone attending college to fill out the form and turn it in on time to maximize financial aid. What could make a big difference in terms of debt at graduation, an area in which North Carolina ranks favorably compared with other states? The average student loan debt for all college graduates nationwide in 2011 was $26,600, according to the Institute for College Access and Success, while North Carolina graduates owed an average of $20,800. And now for Lauren K. Onisorge's column on infotech, biotechnology, and entrepreneurism. Lice and skeeters and bugs, oh my! Morrisville has a scary secret, but it's a secret that could put the triangle on the map in ongoing summer battles against all things creepy crawly. Thanks to a recent $4.5 million fundraiser, the secret is about to go public in a big way. You're not afraid of bugs, are you? It's the first question Jason Smith, group leader of the product development and innovation at Tyratech, asks when I walk into his lab. And there's the funny smell. That's the media, he explains, motioning to a plastic bucket behind a door, a bucket whose content seems, well, alive. See the maggots? The maggots are housed below netted containers of flies, next to a shelf buzzing with more dire contents, mosquitoes, and that's just behind one door. Tyratech's animal containment unit has several rooms with cringe-worthy labels such as flying insects and crawling insects, where you'll find creatures such as pesticide-resistant cockroaches. Those are the kind you really don't want loose in your house, Schmidt explains, as though there is another kind. Schmidt braves the bugs every day so you don't have to. He, along with other Tyratech employees, even puts his arm in a mosquito net full of bloodsuckers. Frequently. Why? Because it's his job, and it's the only way the company can determine whether its products are effective. Tyratech, independently and through a recent joint initiative, develops and tests pesticides, not the plant variety that chemical giants are manufacturing down the road in the Research Triangle Park. No, this is a spray you put on your arms at a picnic. Through a partnership with Terminix, products are already on the shelves at the Home Depot under that brand. Now the company has research on a lice treatment and a mosquito repellent. The lice treatment is due out by the end of 2013. With the recent fundraiser, Tyratech can commercialize the treatments, but it's also seeking partners. The technology, executives say, is needed. A lot of lice, a lot of insects in general, are becoming resistant to treatments, explains Brian Phillips, head of legal and intellectual property for the company. Tyratech claims its products impact different receptors, killing bugs in different ways than competing products and thus minimizing resistance. But the claim to fame of its products isn't in being more lethal than other sprays, even though it maintains that claim as well. It's the organic nature of the chemicals involved. The essential oils are combined in a way that's not only lethal for bugs, but safer for humans, says Keith Kennedy. He's the Vice President of Research and Development. And that's not easy to do, he says. TireTech relocated to Morrisville from Florida in 2011, pledging to bring 105 new jobs. Now, 2 years later, the job total is in the 20s. Phillips says the lower count is because the company forged partnerships rather than bringing on employees. Still, CEO Bruno Jacquetel says the 2 years in North Carolina have been very fruitful, adding that in 2012, we exceeded our goal to commercialize several products with our partners, known as Terminix. This week's Spotlight column is on law. And this column is by Chris Bagley. It's titled, Uncertainty Leads Businesses to Cut Cost. Companies are increasingly insistent on alternative fee arrangements for contracted counsel. Business leaders in virtually every industry say they've been dealing with unprecedented uncertainty since 2007, and that the uncertainty remains even as the recession itself loses its grip. Some details of health care reform remain unclear, for example. And though interest rates are low, businesses are also perceiving uncertainty related to lending and in financial markets. Legal costs have always been something of a question mark for companies, too, and a lot of them have acted to limit their risk on that front. One widely recognized change, companies have increasingly pushed their outside law firms toward fixed fees and other alternative fee arrangements. More than half of all companies with in-house legal departments use the so-called AFAs in each of the last 3 years, compared to less than half in prior years, according to an annual survey by the Houston-based law firm Fulbright & Jaworski. The percentage fell somewhat last year to 51% from 61%, but people in legal services say they believe that's an anomaly. About 80% of lawyers surveyed by the consulting firm Altman Wheel in 2012 believe AFAs have established a permanent foothold, compared to just 20% who said so in 2009. Alternative fee arrangements are going to grow as more and more people want to know what they're going to spend, says legal services consultant Tom Kane, who lives in High Point and works with clients nationwide. The Richmond-based firm William Mullins generated about 17% of its revenue last year under AFAs compared to 12% in the prior year, says Rob Van Arnhem, a partner in the Raleigh office who oversees its use of AFAs. On a similar note, several large companies have moved more legal work in-house and away from outside firms in the last couple of years. Mr. Kane says he believes that's cyclical and not permanent, but the insourcing answers a similar need for control and transparency. Clients can see where their costs are going, where their dollars are going, Kane says. Mimi Soleil, a solo employment attorney in Raleigh, says risk aversion also extends to how companies comply with labor laws. Attorneys are famously, or infamously, risk averse. Lawyers can spend weeks scrutinizing a new contract or law, gaming out all possible ways that something could go awry, and planning for those contingencies. Still, Soule says that increased attention to labor law compliance has helped her build her own practice since she went solo. And that's also true more generally, says Mark Paul, a partner in Baker McKenzie's Washington, D.C. office, who frequently works in the Triangle. The whole atmosphere in this country, compliance has become a bigger issue. This week's question and answer on the legal and law column is with Rob Van Arnhem. Law firms have become more accommodating in the last few years about working for fixed fees and other alternatives to the traditional billable hour. Such alternative fee arrangements are often helpful for clients because it helps them budget legal costs more predictably and because it often saves them money. Triangle Business Journal's Chris Bagley recently spoke with Rob Van Arnhem, an intellectual property attorney in Raleigh who oversees Williams Mullins' use of alternative fees. Triangle Business Journal's question, can you give us an idea of whether how dramatically your use of AFAs have increased in the last couple of years? Van Arnhem, Firm-wide AFAs accounted for 17% of our revenue in the fiscal year that ended, up 12% in the 2012 fiscal year. Triangle. Is it fairly typical for law firms? Van Arnum. I think that is consistent at least with other mid-sized firms. I think it's tougher with some of the really big firms. Their numbers are a little bit lower, and it's harder for them to adjust their model, which may be based on bigger clients and bigger rates. In fairness, though, I think everybody that wants to continue to do this business is looking hard at their billable practices. Triangle. Do AFAs make law firms less profitable? Van Arnum. Not necessarily. In one recent survey of in-house lawyers, more than a third said AFAs are about as profitable as hourly billing, and another 15% thought they were more profitable. Even if a specific matter is less profitable, if you're providing high-quality service for what the client views as a reasonable price, they're going to keep coming back to you. I don't think many firms are going to succeed on being the low-cost provider. Triangle. So, are AFAs more about saving money or predictability? Van Arnum. Saving money doesn't just mean paying a dollar versus a dollar 50. It's about staying within budgets. Triangle. Have corporate clients caused tensions with their law firms by pushing harder for AFAs? Van Arnum. I don't think so. Maybe in some firms there's a struggle internally. In my experience, an AFA prompts a conversation early in a piece of new legal work about budgeting, about cost, and about the value the client wants to see, so there's a lot of planning and discussions that don't typically go on until the end. I think there's less tension because you come to an understanding early on. Triangle. I've read about several instances of large companies expanding their in-house legal departments in order to limit what they spend with outside firms. Has that been common in the last couple of years? Van Arnum. Companies are looking for how to maximize their legal spend, so that's to be expected. And with the economy being what it is, they can hire high-quality legal talent for less than it used to cost. That said, I think there's a lot of work that in-house attorneys aren't getting. If a company has a cyclical business, it's a tough decision to hire an in-house attorney permanently, unless they can be working on other things when a certain type of legal work slows down. Next up, emails in hand, Wake Tech to launch fundraising. By Jason DeBruin from Raleigh. Wake Technical Community College has quietly been collecting data on alumni for years. This summer, the college will go to that database and ask for donations. Developing an alumni base for a two-year college is decidedly more difficult than for a four-year university such as UNC Chapel Hill, NC State, and Duke University. Even if they go to a community college, alums of four-year schools tend to identify with a give back to the school at which they earned their undergraduate or graduate degrees. That's why, 8 years ago, Mort Congleton, Wake Tech's Vice President of College Development, decided that if he wanted to build a base, he first needed to offer alumni something they could use. He started an affinity program in which former WTCC students can receive discounts at varying places throughout the triangle simply by joining the program. He asked for nothing except contact information, and Congleton says he now has more than 100,000 student records and 25,000 email addresses that we think are pretty good, he says. In February, Wake Tech kicked off the public phase of its fundraising campaign, setting a goal to raise $12.5 million to fund scholarships, new technology, and faculty and staff innovation. Congleton now wants to use the alumni base he built to generate donations. Nothing major, he says, but maybe ask alumni for $50 to commemorate Wake Tech's 50th anniversary. The program is called Ripple Effect, and WakeMed Health and Hospital CEO Bill Atkinson serves as the chairman. Congleton plans to reach out particularly to students who receive scholarships themselves, tugging at their heartstrings and encouraging them to help provide scholarships to the next crop of students. Alumni outreach is an area where community college, both in North Carolina and nationwide, could show improvement. A survey conducted by the Council for Advancement and Support of Education, based in Washington, D.C., found that nearly half of responding colleges did not have a single full-time staffer dedicated to alumni relations. More than half of those workers spent less than 20% of their time on alumni relations, and most were employed at the college for fewer than 3 years. The data indicates that where community colleges intentionally and systematically track and engage their former students, they can expect a corresponding increase in philanthropy, wrote Andrew Paradise and Paul Heaton in their survey conclusion. Alumni relations and foundation performance are not things the North Carolina Community College office tracks, says Megan Honick, the college systems director for external affairs, but pointed to Sand Hills Community College as an example of a strong alumni relations program. That college, which with a headcount of 5,300 falls on the smaller end of colleges, reestablished its alumni program in 2007, thanks in part to a 3-year, $30,000 donation to get the program kicked off. It has a budget of less than $5,000 per year and now counts 2,000 members in its group, from which it raised $40,000 last year. We feel we have really cemented the alumni outreach role in our development efforts, says Jermaine Brandt Elkins, director of foundation operations at Sandhills. The college hired Jennifer Blakely, who is the director of all the foundation's outreach efforts and spends about one-third of her time advancing alumni efforts, according to Elkins. Here's a bit of good news. Wake County bankruptcies are at their lowest level since 2008. Fewer Wake County residents filed for bankruptcy in the first 4 months of the year than in any January-April period since 2008, according to statistics released May 7th by the U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the Eastern District of North Carolina. The 654 debtors filing for bankruptcy since the beginning of 2013 represent a 23% decline from the same period of 2012, and the 183 new petitions filed in April were 13% fewer than in April 2012. The vast majority of bankruptcy filers are individuals and couples. While those numbers suggest a recovering economy, the view isn't quite as rosy for businesses. Counts by the Triangle Business Journal in several recent months show business-related bankruptcies at and just above year-ago numbers. A new Triangle Business Journal analysis shows liabilities totaling between $525 million and $735 million for corporate bankruptcies filed in eastern North Carolina in 2012. Exact numbers aren't available because some companies specify their liabilities in broad ranges, but a look through the numbers suggests that the average company had about $4 million in liabilities and $3.5 million in assets. The analysis includes mainly for-profit companies, with a sprinkling of nonprofits such as churches that filed in the Durham, Raleigh, or Wilson branch of the bankruptcy court system. Continuing on, in surprise to the company, China OK's BioCris drug. By Lauren K. Onisorge from Durham. BioCris could be China's last line of defense against a deadly flu strain. But that's only if Pirmavir, BioCris flu vaccine, provides a worthy adversary to the strain, and the deck seems stacked against it. After all, the intravenous treatment couldn't reach endpoints in its own Phase 3 trial. Regardless, Pirmavir could bring some desperately needed good news to BioCris. It depends on several factors, and those factors are starting to come into play. H7N9, what the World Health Organization is calling a particularly lethal strain of influenza, is causing more than headlines. It's causing widespread panic. That's according to Dr. William Schaffner, one of the world's leading experts on flu and the chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. Schaffner, who just got back from a Centers for Disease Control briefing on the illness, says the high mortality virus has prompted a waiting game within the medical community. At the moment, this virus doesn't have the genetic capacity to move from person to person readily, but We're keeping our eyes on it because if it does pick up that capacity, it might well cause another worldwide pandemic of influenza, he says. And China doesn't want to be on the losing side of the battle. That's why, in a surprise announcement, Chinese officials said they approved BioCryst Pemivir for use in the Asian country. BioCryst CEO John Stonehouse was as surprised as anyone, having found out the same way many others did, through colleagues who read the news. It's one more piece of evidence that this drug is approvable, he says, and while BioCryst has no licensed drug in China, he's excited that it could make a difference. If we were able to contribute in some way, that's very motivating. Rob Bennett, Executive Director for Investor Relations and Communications for BioCryst, says China's decision to approve the drug shows doubters that Pemivir is a credible treatment. You've got to believe that the Chinese government, having proved it so quickly, has some idea of its effect on this virus, he says. Should the flu prompt a pandemic, there's no guarantee that Pemivir would even work against the strain, but it was developed for seasonal flu. But there's good news. The H7N9 virus, Schaffner says, does seem to be susceptible to the current antiviral drugs available, including Tamiflu. If Pemivir is proven effective against seasonal flu, it's likely to follow suit. You always want to have options, and having new options for the treatment of influenza is a good thing, Schaffner says. But as BioCryst hasn't licensed the treatment to China, the impact of BioCryst would be more in credibility than in cash. Pemivir was developed through a $235 million contract with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. By the time the research was suspended on the treatment, the government had poured in $188 million of that sum, leading to the investor community and Summit BioCryst to believe its story might be over. But Stonehouse got another recent surprise, this time from the home front. Despite the drug's FDA failure, the FDA is planning to meet with BioCryst leaders to talk about a new drug application for Pemivir. And Stonehouse is holding out hope that the government won't just approve and keep funding the drug, but that it will also be a buyer. He's betting on Pemivir to get an FDA stamp of approval, and if it happens, he'll push to create a seasonal version of Pemivir. As the drug is primarily intended for stockpile sales, it won't be the financial savior of the company. That's pressure BioCryst is putting on its other two compounds, one for hereditary angioedema and another for viruses such as yellow fever. But for a company halved after recent layoffs, good news isn't just about the revenue. It's all about attitude. Just as November, with its failed merger and trial suspension, brought it bad luck, April could be known as the month where it started to turn around. But it all depends. Currently, BioCryst has 37 employees, and 23 of them are in Durham. This week's 9 to 5 column. The first ever North Carolina State University College of Design has awarded its highest honors, the Design Guild Award, to a construction company. Raleigh-based Clancy & Thays Construction Company, led for the past 27 years by Tim Clancy and Tick Clancy, was recognized with the award at an event hosted by College of Design Dean Marvin Malekia. Past recipients have included Philip Freeland, William Ivy Long, and Greg Hatman. The Design Guild Award exists to recognize individuals or companies who work in an exemplary fashion to promote and nurture art and design as a fundamental aspect of our culture. Among the projects that Clancy and Thays has helped build in the region include restorations of the North Carolina State Capitol and Executive Mansion, Christ Church, the Nature Research Center, and State Employees Credit Daily Planet Buildings, as well as the AIA North Carolina Center for Architecture and Design in downtown Raleigh. Next, Kane Realty. Chief Operating Officer Mike Smith of Raleigh has taken a seat on the North Carolina Board of Transportation, along with 9 other new members. Smith represents District 5, which includes the counties of Wake, Durham, Franklin, Granville, Person, Vance, and Warren. Board of Transportation members give input to the Department of Transportation staff in thinking through broad transportation priorities. Most represent geographic districts, though some at-large members are charged with specific modes of transportation. Mr. Smith earned an MBA at UNC Chapel Hill, and he has worked for Citicorp Asia, Bank of America Securities, and PNC Capital Markets. He is a Triangle Business Journal named Smith one of the 40 Under 40 Young Business Leaders in 2004. Also, new product launches mean budget increases. That's according to a new report by Cutting Edge Information that shows new product launches can double a medical affairs team's financial resources at some biopharmaceutical companies. Data shows that regardless of a company's size, medical affairs departments have to allocate additional funds to support a product, and they have to do it well before a product's expected approval date. It's typical that larger companies shift their resources from older to newer brands, while smaller companies often have to build out completely new departments, such as their first medical science liaison team. That's the end of the 9-to-5 column. This week's Small Business Spotlight is on Peter Bohenik and Associates. And this article is from Chapel Hill by Dale Gibson. Ask a writer, a highly accomplished one at that, for a review of work done by a contractor, and you get a flowing answer. The landscape I had dreamt of, but not been able to articulate, he had somehow divined, is the way Tim Krause, author of The Boys on the Bus, a landmark book about media coverage of the 1972 presidential campaign, described the work of Peter Bohenik in fashioning a raw and rugged acre of land in Chapel Hill to his liking. Bohenik and his partner of 15 years, Gay Enright, make up the landscape design team that is Peter Bohenik and Associates Incorporated. Like many people fed up with growth issues, crime, and taxes in California, they relocated to Chapel Hill in 1999. Prior to working in the San Francisco Bay Area, Bohenik did landscape design work in the Tony Hamptons area of Long Island, New York. Finding his way to the Triangle was natural for Bohenik, who earned a bachelor's degree in landscape architecture from North Carolina State University. He has a master's in landscape architecture from Harvard University. Also trained as a sculptor, Bohenik says he is called in when people have no idea what to do. While Bohenik's shop is small, and he and Enright have a trained group of landscapers who execute their designs, including hoisting heavy boulders that Bohenik handpicks from an aged landslide in western Virginia. At any time, the firm is juggling about 5 jobs, 2 in construction and 3 in conceptualization. This is not low-end landscape work. Jobs can run well into 6 figures, and annual billings can approach $2 million. Bohenik approaches his work with the eye of an artist, charged with the task of executing the vision of a client. "We are garden artists," he says. "Your garden is the expression of your inner needs, and it is not subject to fashion or popular style." Like Bohenik, Krause escaped California and chose Chapel Hill because of a long-held memory. In his first assignment for Rolling Stone magazine in the 1960s, he was dispatched to Chapel Hill to do a story on the Taylor family, as in songwriter James Taylor and his father Ike Taylor, who was dean of the UNC Chapel Hill School of Medicine at the time. He recalls Chapel Hill as being a beautiful and open community, but when he moved here and found the neighborhood he wanted, only one lot remained, and it was a challenge. What I'd pictured as almost flat terrain in fact consisted of a plunging declivity giving way to a slightly gentler declivity. The house went up on a shelf between the two slopes. It was surrounded by red mud. Krause asked Bohenik to incorporate 2 features into his design for the land: a creek that did not exist, but he'd always yearned for it as a boyhood summer home on the north shore of Massachusetts, and birch trees that did exist in abundance on that New England turf. Now a man-made stream snakes through Krause's property, so near a screened porch that babbles are part of the environment, gathers into a pool and cascades down a slope at the back of the property. Lichened boulders were shipped in, and what were saplings 15 years ago when the property was landscaped are now fully mature river birch trees. It looks as if it's always been here, a garden that nature created. Krauss writes of his garden, which, of course, was created by Peter Bohenik, using nature's inventory of goodies. This week's letter to the editor is from Mr. Stuart Weitzman, who is the director of the Eastman Innovation Center. We would like to thank North Carolina State University and Triangle Communities for the warm welcome they have given the Eastman Innovation Center since it opened earlier this spring. The leadership of Eastman Chemical Company was privileged to enjoy the company of NC State leaders, faculty, staff, and students at the opening of the Innovation Center on April 18th in the Partners II building of Centennial Campus. It was a great event. We thank everyone who was there for their attendance. Eastman is excited about the possibilities that exist through our partnerships with both NC State and UNC. We expect the research we are doing together in chemistry, materials science, and other disciplines will yield results that will improve processes and products that people use all over the world. We also hope that being located near the Research Triangle Park will yield synergies we have not yet forecast. As the Triangle Business Journal has reported, the article was Eastman pledges $10 million in research in the April 26th edition. Eastman enjoys a special relationship with NC State. Our research agreement creates opportunities for shared success that are unique to partnerships between enterprises and universities. Our handling of intellectual property rights through a success-sharing model recognizes the value of certain discoveries towards Eastman's strategic goals, while also giving NC State rights to acknowledge that could be valuable to the school. Our partnership is designed for all parties to share in the accomplishments and the value of the work. This kind of agreement could not have been possible without the extraordinary leadership of NC State Chancellor Randy Woodson. Terry Lomax, Lee Burton, and their respective staffs have demonstrated an understanding of the needs of a company like Eastman. We considered many universities for our Innovation Center, and NC State's leadership, particularly in the area of intellectual property, put it ahead of the pack. This week's guest opinion column is from Mr. Roy Cooper. Mr. Cooper is the Attorney General of North Carolina. And this article is entitled, Timing Cannot Be Better for Hospitals to Consider Their Impact. Healthcare costs continue to rise, eating into family budgets and hurting the bottom line for businesses. It's a problem that can't be solved by North Carolina alone, but there are changes we can make here that will help consumers make sense out of their bills and give them more purchasing power. Each year, my office receives more than 20,000 written consumer complaints, and healthcare has long been a top culprit. It's clear we need to restore some fairness to medical billing and collection practices. I'm also concerned about the growing trend of mergers and acquisitions among healthcare facilities. It's important that they not result in higher costs and fewer choices for consumers and businesses. Based on what my office has heard from consumers and work we've done on these issues, I've made the following recommendations to state legislatures. 1. Consumers need more time to request an itemized bill. Under current law, consumers can get an itemized medical bill only if they request it within 30 days of discharge. Hospitals and other healthcare facilities have up to 3 years to file a collections action, and it seems only fair that consumers have at least that long to request an itemized bill. 2. Bills need to be in an easy-to-understand language. Consumers shouldn't have to wade through incomprehensible medical codes and undefined jargon to make sense of the charges. 3. Consumers shouldn't pay the price for a healthcare facility's insurance filing failures. Sometimes a healthcare facility fails to submit information to a consumer's insurer on time, and as a result, the insurer fails to provide coverage. We've heard from consumers who faced hundreds or even thousands of dollars in extra charges because the hospital didn't file insurance paperwork on time, and that's not fair. 4. Consumers who've overpaid for care whether it's because insurance reimbursement came after a payment or a clerical error, should get a refund within 60 days or less. Likewise, when a healthcare facility commits a billing error that impacts many patients, everyone who was overcharged should get their money back, not just those who happen to catch the problem and complain about it. 5. Consumers deserve a prompt and accurate answer about whether a provider is in their insurance network. 6. Consumers deserve a reasonable amount of time to apply for charity care. Patients have told my office they were denied charity care even though they qualified for it financially because the hospital said they didn't apply soon enough. In other states, people have a year or more to apply for charity care. 7. Healthcare facilities should abide by reasonable collection practices. Consumers should get at least 30 days' notice before their account is sent to collections, and it shouldn't be sent while their application for charity care is pending. Debt collectors should inform patients of their right to apply for financial assistance, and they should get written consent from a healthcare facility before taking a patient to court. Patients shouldn't lose their home through forced sale or foreclosure because they can't pay their medical bills. And finally, 8, healthcare facilities should be required to give notice of mergers and acquisitions. We recently won a victory when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled state healthcare facilities are not immune from antitrust laws. To better exercise this authority, we need timely notice of mergers and acquisitions. Healthcare facilities should have to notify my office and the Federal Trade Commission when they merge or acquire a facility or physician practice. Band Together raised $852,000 for the nonprofit's partnership with the Tammy Lynn Center for Developmental Disabilities, breaking its previous record of $566,000 raised last year. In total, the organization has raised $3 million for local nonprofits. Formed in 2001, Band Together North Carolina uses music as a means for social change. Band Together's annual concert event is organized and led by a team of more than 500 volunteers from across the Triangle. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at trianglereadingservice.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.